Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Wales podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. In this episode, you join us for our annual free word lecture, which aims to uphold the ethos of free speech with a focus on the power and politics of words. This year, we hear from journalist Sukunda Kamani, renowned for his fearless reporting, and have played a leading role in covering the ongoing conflict in the Middle East. Recorded live at the 2024 Bradford Literature Festival, this lecture explores the transformative and democratising power of words and the importance of freedom of expression.
Thank you so much for the introduction. It's wonderful. It's an honour and a pleasure to be here at the Bradford Literature Festival and to be speaking in front of you. As a reporter, I'm not used to holding forth on for such long periods of time or talking to audiences. I'm normally behind, well, in front of the camera, but kind of covered up by speaking to other people, letting them hold forth. So it's a new experience for me. But I wanted to share some reflections, really, from some of the reporting that myself and colleagues have been doing over the past year, particularly in places where freedom of speech is very difficult. I had my most vivid first-hand insight into how brazenly false, at times conceivably credible, allegations made by senior figures in positions of political power can be, and by extension, the importance of unfettered on-the-ground journalism. When I was earlier this year standing by the side of a road in Lahore, Pakistan, I was there in the aftermath of the country's elections, which turned out to be much more interesting than anyone had anticipated them being. I travelled out to report on the crackdown faced by the party led by the former Prime Minister Imran Khan. He was and still remains in jail on charges that are widely regarded as politically motivated. But his real crime, it seems, was to have fallen out with Pakistan's powerful military. Pakistan's often described as not a country with an army, but an army with a country. The army leadership had, from behind the scenes, helped bring Imran Khan into power. Then they had helped a few years later, as they often do with civilian leaders, pushed him out. And now, in these elections, they were determined to stop his party performing well, despite major grassroots public support. Unfortunately, their attempts to do so were at times quite amateur, and so candidates allied to Imran Khan had performed unexpectedly well, and there were widespread, very credible allegations that fraud had prevented them winning an even greater number of seats. So I was at a protest by the side of this road, led by one politician, not a particularly well-known figure, and his supporters who were disputing the results in their constituency. Traffic was more or less still managing to flow by. The atmosphere was peaceful. If you're a driver in Lahore, then a few dozen people in the middle of the road is not going to particularly rattle you. You deal with more with more traffic obstacles than that on your average commute. But all of a sudden, the police, who had been up until then just kind of standing by, loitering around, charged towards this crowd, wielding their batons. And they detained some of the protesters, including this candidate. They even went as far as to puncture the tyres of one of the vehicles. I overheard them saying, "Don't smash up the car because the press are there." So I found it interesting that was where their kind of limit lay, that you shouldn't smash the windows, but it's okay to puncture their tyres. When it was all over, and it didn't take long because the crowd quickly dispersed or were taken away, I walked up to the senior most policeman who was there, the largest policeman. And I said, "What was all that about?" And I asked him deliberately in English, because as anyone who's got multiple identities knows, there's a time to try and pass off as a local and there's a time to try and pass off as a foreigner. And given the police's attitude at that time, I thought, now's definitely a time to be a Brit, not a Pakistani. And this hulking policeman just kind of turned to me and said, "Roadblock." And I was like, "And, you know, what about all of this?" You know, trying to imitate the truncheon swirling around. And he just gave another shrug and a grin and kind of turned away from me. All of that was pretty much standard fare, but what really resonated with me was what happened next. And this politician who had been detained was charged, and not with blocking the road, but with firing a gun at a senior policeman. And I had been there for practically the start to absolutely the end of the demonstration, there was not a single shot fired. There was not a single gun in sight. And there were other local Pakistani journalists who were there covering, but often in Pakistan, journalists, you know, pay a terrible price for contradicting the official stance. Some have been abducted, some have been attacked, some have been lost their jobs. So, you know, we as a privileged international reporters were able to say what we saw, but many of them wouldn't have been able to do so. And it's not necessarily in the scale of everything that's happening in the world the most egregious injustice, but it really resonated with me because I began thinking, how would I have thought about this particular event if I had not been there? If I had perhaps just read a few lines in a local newspaper about this politician being arrested, or read a few tweets from Imran Khan supporters saying, oh, this politician has been stitched up. And, you know, a lot of people have a lot of guns in Pakistan, including politicians. It's not inconceivable that someone would have fired in the course of some kind of heated clash with police a gun. It's also not inconceivable that the allegation could have been malicious and fraudulent. But probably if I wasn't there, the whole he said, she said aspect of things would have meant that I would have just shrugged it off myself and said, well, it was one of those things that we're just never going to know, or I'm never going to know. That's because if you're spreading disinformation or you're trying to cover something up, you don't actually have to fully convince someone of your lie. You just have to buy their apathy or create doubt and confusion in their mind by muddying the water with your allegation. We saw a very effective example of this in Syria during the war there, when pro-Russian figures started talking about the White Helmets Rescue Service, alleging that they were terrorists. They went around, as many of you will remember, I'm sure, filming themselves as they salvaged children, distressed civilians in the aftermath of Russian or Syrian regime airstrikes. They were not terrorists, but some of the Syrian armed rebel groups who were operating there had, or could, in the past certainly at least, had links to groups like Al-Qaeda. And the allegation really began to stick and became quite prevalent in some circles. Of course, now the most contested conflict of our time is that in Gaza, where so many Palestinians have been and continue to be killed. And we've seen at times Israeli officials making false claims about Palestinian civilian deaths, describing some of the horrific videos coming out from Gaza of dead and injured children, for example, as products of Pallywood, in other words, Palestinian propaganda. In one instance, the official State of Israel Twitter account alleged that a dead child was in fact a doll, and he was being cradled outside a morgue by his relatives. And of course, that was not true. That was not a doll. That was a real child who, according to his family, was killed in an Israeli strike. But this claim was shared by multiple other official government embassy accounts, as well as many other unofficial ones with large followings. And we've seen Hamas, for their part, claim that they did not deliberately target civilians on October the 7th, when there have been videos that I've seen, for example, showing gunmen chasing down young women who'd been attending the music festival and shooting them at point-blank range. The now notorious claim of 40 beheaded Israeli babies is perhaps one of the starkest examples of how quickly and how far false information can spread. I was there in Kibbutz Kfar Aza as journalists were first let in after October the 7th. It was a very distressing sight. There was a strong smell of death in the air. It was clear that many people had been killed. There were bodies that were still being collected. But no one in the Israeli military told us anything about having found dozens of babies or beheaded babies. In fact, it was that evening when we were finishing off the edit of our report that colleagues in London called us and said, well, these reports are spreading. What do you guys think about it? And we looked into it and saw that it seemed to stem from a single interview with Israeli TV by a single Israeli soldier who, even in his interview, wasn't really clear whether he was saying that he knew this had happened, or he was saying that he knew this had happened, or he was just simply asserting as a fact something that he had heard as a rumor. And, you know, in reality, we now know that there were no beheaded babies in Kfar Aza. There were not 40 babies who were killed on October the 7th, though there were plenty of other genuine atrocities that did take place. But the claim made it all the way to the White House. And of course, the speed in which information is now transmitted on social media, way that many people on social media, or some people on social media, have become primarily interested in either propagating their narrative or in growing their own influence for commercial reasons. This is a big problem now. You know, that is a major part of how false information spreads, as is the kind of echo chamber effect of social media, where you just expose largely to views that you already know and hold. But the dangers of echo chambers aren't just restricted to social media. It's part of a report earlier this year in which I was trying to delve into why audiences in Israel see the images of death and destruction in Gaza so differently to people in many other parts of the world. We analyzed the evening news bulletins on three of Israel's most popular TV channels over the course of the week, and there was not a single clip of a Palestinian in Gaza talking about what they were going through. People in Israel simply weren't seeing in the same way the conflict that we were seeing from the outside. And, you know, there was plenty of coverage of the war, of course, but it was all from the perspective of Israeli soldiers or from the perspective of the families of Israeli hostages who were sent there. But certainly none of the kind of emotive scenes of the aftermath of airstrikes or injured children and people in hospital waiting rooms that we've all become grimly accustomed to seeing. There are Israeli newspapers that are much more critical in their reporting. And of course, it's not as if, you know, Israelis are totally unaware of what's happening in Gaza. Many are aware, but have different beliefs, that they are perhaps either so filled with anger, pain, and a desire for revenge after the awful events of October the 7th that they don't have much sympathy for the Palestinians in Gaza, or decide that they believe that the kind of whole territory is in some way complicit with it. Others have a view that Hamas is ultimately responsible. We tried to carry out an experiment where we showed footage of these, you know, terrible scenes from Gaza to three Israeli students who were from Tel Aviv and asked them what they thought about it. They were all taken aback, as anyone would be. Despite all coming from different political persuasions, they, this was back in December, all said that they believed that ultimately Hamas was responsible, that the Israeli army would never want to deliberately kill Palestinian civilians. And it was a very telling moment in explaining the disconnect between the views in Israel and, as I say, in much of the rest of the world. And interestingly, on echo chambers, as part of that same experiment, we showed some footage from October the 7th to three students from the West Bank who had all clearly had been traumatized by their experience of the Israeli occupation. But they looked at footage and their response was unanimous in saying that we don't trust any of this, even when I assured them that I was only showing them footage that had been verified by us, by other international outlets or fact checkers. And so echo chambers are prevalent in many different circles. When it comes to the claims and counterclaims about what's happening inside Gaza now, as you know, Israel and Egypt have refused to allow foreign journalists to travel independently into the territory. And that would have helped us be able to delve into some of these disputes. Of course, there are brave local Palestinian journalists who are there, who are paying an unacceptable price with their lives as they document the suffering there. But Israel discredits them, saying they're not impartial. Hamas, we do know, in the past has attempted to suppress coverage that is critical of it. The health ministry there does not distinguish between killed combatants and civilians. They break it down by men, women, and children. But the impact on ordinary people in Gaza is very clear to see from the footage filmed by these local journalists. And if Israel disputes the veracity of their reporting, it would seem that the only logical thing to do would be to allow foreign independent journalists in to see what we can uncover about the reality. It doesn't really make sense that we're not allowed there for our own safety when international charity workers, UN staff members are being allowed in. And so the question you end up asking yourself is, what do they not want us to see? Is it the allegations of war crimes that Israel disputes are taking place that others allege are taking place? I did travel into Gaza last November once with the Israeli military. It was a decision that we as a team and as Channel 4 News thought very carefully about and whether it was the right thing to do or not. In the end, we decided that it was at that stage because it would allow us to get at least some kind of first-hand glimpse of the situation there and that we would be able to challenge directly the Israeli military officers who were there. And so we went and it was an apocalyptic seen. There was destroyed buildings, and we were taken to what Israel described as a humanitarian corridor, what Palestinians described as an example of ethnic cleansing, where huge numbers of tens of thousands of Palestinians were making their way from northern Gaza down to the south after being ordered to leave by the Israeli army. I remember very clearly one man pulling along, I imagine, his mother or grandmother on a chair, not a wheelchair, but just perhaps an office chair with two wheels on it. Others were holding white flags or had their hands held above their heads. And I asked the Israeli soldiers who we were with, can I go and speak to these people? And they said no. And that was that, really. There was nothing I could do more in that situation. But what I could do when we got back into our edit was to take and incorporate into our report footage filmed by local Palestinian journalists from that same road on that same day, giving our audiences a fuller perspective, along with our interviews challenging and talking to Israeli military officials. And that episode really underlined to me both the limits in an era of smartphones and social media of physically attempting to prevent access to journalists, and also still how prevalent a tactic it is. I spent a lot of time in Afghanistan in the lead up to the Taliban takeover and in the aftermath to it. Right now there, it's practically impossible to do free and fair reporting, although strangely, initially when the Taliban took over, it was a very different case. And because the Taliban were still figuring out how they were going to govern, because they were at that stage keen to engage with foreign journalists thinking they could influence how the world saw them, we, as from a privileged position of international journalists, were able to travel much more widely than we had ever been able to do in the past. The war was over. The guys that we perhaps were previously afraid of were now the guys who were in government. And so we went to, you know, drugs labs in the middle of the desert that were producing tens of millions of pounds worth of crystal meth. We went to people smuggling hubs, you know, in the far west of the country. But it was whilst reporting on the drug trade that I saw the attitudes were beginning to shift within the Taliban. And we had tried to film in a small village in Helmand province that has long been a hub for the heroin trade. And as an insurgency, the Taliban made significant amount of money from taxing drug production. Now, as the de facto government, they've actually been remarkably efficient in stamping out opium production. But at that stage, it was very much booming. We'd gone in traditional Afghan clothes and kind of a team who all looked aesthetically at least like they could be local, or so we thought. But, you know, as soon as we got there, we realized we stuck out like sore thumbs, and everyone was just staring into our little beaten up taxi window thinking, who the hell are these guys? And we were told very quickly, once they realized that we weren't there to buy kind of large amounts of heroin ourselves, that we needed to go and get permission from some more senior Taliban officials. So we went to meet the Taliban's provincial minister for information, and this was a man with a really ferocious reputation. He had lost one eye, I believe, in while building explosives a few months earlier. In the kind of last days of the war, he had claimed responsibility for the assassination of a very well-respected local Helmandi Afghan journalist. But I was a bit cocky, having travelled around the country quite a bit at that stage, and so I adopted an indignant tone, and I said to him, well, why are you not allowing us to film in this heroin village, aware that it was probably slightly ridiculous? We had a long back and forth, and he said, look, there's no way I'm going to let you to film that, but you can do an interview with me. And so again, slightly cockily, I said, right, I'm going to really grill this guy, because, you know, I wanted to get to the heart of the story. We'd spent the whole day traveling up and down these dirt roads, and we hadn't managed to get anything so far. And so I said to him, look, on camera, why are you not allowing us to film? Is it because there are senior Taliban commanders here in Helmand who are profiting from this trade, and you know the central Taliban government might well ban it soon, and you don't want it to be aired? And he was kind of umming and ahhing and, you know, really feeling the pressure for a bit. And then it suddenly dawned on him that actually I don't need to take this from this, you know, journalist from bloody London. And he just batted, well, not me, thankfully, but batted the camera to the side and said, this, looking me straight in the eye, this is not an interview, this is an interrogation, and I will not stand for it. And, you know, the whole thing ended with basically him threatening to smash our equipment, and I suspected smash much more if we did not delete the interview. Now, I and many other journalists who spent significant periods of time in Afghanistan are on a list of banned figures held by the Taliban's intelligence services. We are not allowed in the country, although some other reporters are, and travel vloggers, interestingly, are there going around making YouTube videos. They have to tell the Taliban where they're going, who they're meeting, what their plans are. It's not the recipe for, of course, for any kind of real meaningful journalism. So old school bans on journalists getting into places can still be effective, but to an extent, because at the same time, no one thinks, oh, well, everything's hunky-dory in Afghanistan, or the Taliban are treating, you know, women and girls okay just because, you know, a bunch of foreign journalists are no longer there reporting it firsthand. It's not going to shape global opinion. What I think is a bigger threat is our own and our audience's attention spans. There's now so much information about so many different crises and so many places. How can we do them all justice? I've just recently come back from Myanmar, where peaceful former pro-democracy protesters who had taken to the streets against a military coup in 2021 have now picked up arms and joined hands with long-standing ethnic militias to wage an armed insurgency against a very brutal military dictatorship there. And, you know, against all odds, despite being massively outgunned, they're remarkably successful. They control huge swathes of the country, but there's no tangible international support for their struggle, very limited global public interest in it. And the young fighters I met would often contrast the level of attention that they received with the level of attention devoted, for example, to the fight in Ukraine. And of course, it's difficult to get into rebel-held Myanmar. The junta there don't want journalists either. So, you know, we had to smuggle ourselves in through Thailand and go along the river and, you know, very, very bumpy roads for many hours. But, and, you know, the comparison to Ukraine is different because, of course, the Russian invasion has a different level of geopolitical ramifications. But ultimately, I could understand the frustration of these young men and women who had given up everything they knew of their lives in cities, for example, and gone off to live in the jungle and quite possibly die fighting in this brutal civil war to see a democratic system established. It is the responsibility of journalists like myself and of media outlets to bring attention to audiences about terrible events that are taking place right across the world. But we are fundamentally competing for people's attentions. And studies now show that more people than ever are actively avoiding news because they find it boring, because they find it relentless. And compassion fatigue is a very real thing. I understand. Often I also feel at times overwhelmed by, right now, for example, it might be by the sheer number of horrible videos that are coming out from Gaza. And we wonder what it is that our response should be to that. And it's our responsibility as journalists to keep finding ways to make our reports engaging. But I think there is also a duty that we all have, which is to care. I remember when I was starting out as a journalist, the question I would always be asked by editors when pitching any report was, why should someone here care in the UK? Why does it, or how does it affect their lives? And honestly, the reality is with many foreign news stories, at least the foreign news stories that interest me, it doesn't really massively impact our lives here at all. But does that mean that people don't or shouldn't care? Many people clearly do care. But when there are deliberate attempts to try and cover up events or spread misinformation, I think we all have to make a concerted effort to try extra hard to get to the truth. Thank you so much.
We're going to have a Q&A session now, which it's my honour to facilitate. Does anybody have any questions, or shall I start off? So we have one at the back there, if we can take that first.
Thank you. It's lovely to hear you speak. I just want to know, were you ever in a situation where you thought, I seriously need to reconsider my career? Maybe this is just a bit too much. And also, you're a journalist, and we've seen how relentlessly journalists have been targeted. There was the case of Arshad Sharif in Pakistan, who was, you know, relentlessly. How do you feel? Do you feel safe and protected while you're doing your job?
As for instances where I've felt kind of under physical threat or felt afraid, there have been a few, actually not as many as I feel perhaps there should have been, meeting the kind of people who we often meet in who are, you know, at the very front line, the people that we're filming, the people that who are trusting us with their stories. There was one example that now brings a slight smile to my face just because of the kind of slight absurdity to it, which was straight after, on October the 8th in Israel, myself and a team were filming in Ofakim, which is one of the towns that had been attacked in Israel. We were interviewing people who had witnessed the events, and then there started being some reports circulating that perhaps there were still Hamas fighters on the loose, and so it was time for us to leave. So we all got into our car, and because we'd been feeling quite confident, we hadn't got our protective gear on or anything like that, and so we started driving out, and then we suddenly thought maybe we should put our helmets and stuff on, actually. So then we paused, got out, and then everyone put their helmets on, and everyone was rushing to do it. And for some reason, I was the last person at the back, and I was trying to close the van door, and the van door wasn't closing. And I was frantically slamming this van door, getting increasingly worried about what might be coming up the road. Also conscious of the fact that our protective gear at that stage didn't have press written on it. I asked the driver to come and help me, but he was in his own kind of panic and said, just bloody do it, mate, and get in the car. And up the road, in fact, came four Israeli soldiers with their guns trained straight at me, shouting at me in Hebrew to get down on the floor, which, of course, I did. And everyone else came out of the car as well and shouted in my kind of best imitation of a Hugh Grant voice, British journalist. And you know, we were okay. But yeah, I mean, especially given what we've seen, you know, subsequent to that unfolding in Gaza, I do sometimes think back on that and think that, you know, that I was a youngish brown man with unmarked protective gear, frantically slamming a car door in an area where there has been active fighting very recently. I could have easily, you know, something could have happened. As for what's happening to other journalists, look, I think as foreign journalists, we're in a privileged position where things, of course, can happen to us, but the people who are really at risk are local journalists. Ultimately, that's who authoritarian governments generally fear the most, because even when I was at the BBC, for example, what would resonate about our reports in Afghanistan or Pakistan might not necessarily be so much the impact that it gets from the 6 or 10 o'clock news here, but it's when it gets translated into the BBC Urdu or Pashto or Dari service, and it gets picked up locally then, especially if other journalists who are local, who are under the cosh and can't say these things, then people there, and a lot of these countries have, you know, very high levels of digital literacy. So a lot of people are consuming news on Facebook or social media, for example. And so that's who kind of authoritarian figures often fear the most, because either local journalists or the local colleagues of ours, because they're the ones who are transmitting this information to their own electorate or their own population. And I think we're absolutely indebted to local journalists, and we all need to do more to remember them and to honour the fact that the sacrifices they make, and give recognition to the fact that anytime we pitch up in a foreign country, 90% or 99% of the work that we are able to do is because of we're working in conjunction with them, and they don't always get the honour, but they often pay the price.
Thank you, Simon. Two quick questions, Sukhandar. The first one is that on a human level, and I know that I've messaged you about this, you're absorbing an awful lot. There's an awful lot of trauma. The first thing is, how do you look after yourself? And then the second thing is that Alex Crawford has been doing an awful lot of work trying to, you know, with governments and with the US and other journalists around the world, really, to try and work towards getting foreign journalists into places like Gaza. What is happening in that respect? Where are people at, and where is Channel 4 at in terms of trying to make that happen? So two questions.
In terms of the impact on me, I always feel that the people who are really experiencing the trauma, the people who are living through it, we get to dip into it. That helps me process it. But often, actually, maybe this would resonate with your own experiences, I find it more distressing to watch the news than to report on it. And that's because when I'm reporting on the news, you see it through literally a professional lens, just like I imagine a doctor sees the job of carrying out an amputation. I mean, it's a very distressing act, but it's part of the job, so there's a sense of professional duty. But when I'm at home and I watch something, that's often where I'm more likely to tear up. Of course, there are instances where you do feel very emotional, but yeah, it's more when I'm home and my guard down that you feel it. As for getting into Gaza, I mean, at some stage it has to happen, at some stage, but honestly, as to when that might happen, it's very hard to see, especially now that the Rafah border crossing has been taken control of by the Israelis. The Egyptians have closed it from their side. The Egyptians, prior to that, were not showing any willingness to allow international journalists in. So maybe if and when the conflict ends, if that happens, maybe we'll be allowed in. But it's a huge source of frustration. And it's something that I know a lot of journalists feel a sense of guilt about, that we should be there playing our part, and unfortunately we can't be.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for your lecture. It's really, really interesting. Yeah, I'm concerned about what to believe in media. Obviously, there's lots of mainstream media outlets, mostly have agendas. Some voices are amplified, some voices are completely forgotten. For example, you know, just in the recent election, we had Nigel Farage on the BBC all the time, no Greens, even though there was exactly the same number of MPs elected. It's the same in social media. Some people have got agendas, some people are pushing a commercial agenda. Often, for example, in the Financial Times is the place to get really good information. That's because they've got good teams, and that's because capital needs the information, and that's prioritised over people. So my concern is, and my question to you is, how do you know what to believe and when, and how do you get the right information to get your views, the clear views, the proper views, the things that you really need to know about? People keep talking about the truth, whatever that is. You know, do we just have pure plural voices and we take in lots of different voices and we make a decision on that just based on what they're saying to us? How is it we just get through this? It's like a labyrinth of information from different people, different sources, many of whom have an agenda that we don't even know what it is.
Absolutely. You know, I understand the sense of confusion and the sense of frustration that you have. In defence of fellow journalists, I think that often there's less a case of institutional bias and perhaps more one of sometimes people make mistakes, bad decisions are made. It happens in all walks of life and all professions. If it happens and it leads to an interview going one way or another, then, you know, it gets a lot more attention than if it happens in another field. Of course, there are different voices that get highlighted. I absolutely accept that. The only solution, I think, is really to try and read as widely as possible. But it's also, you're constrained by your own time. And you know, we can't all, there's so much news. I feel there's so much news. How on earth do you keep up with it? But at least if we're engaging, I think if we're asking ourselves the question, that means we're engaging with new sources critically, and that's a very good start. And if we're engaging with things critically and conscious of where the biases or possible agendas may be coming from, then I think we're in a good place. I think the problem is right now a lot of people are not even necessarily asking that question, or they've gone so far to the other side and they've said, right, all mainstream media is all nonsense. I'm going to get everything I want from Instagram, which may feel very raw and unfiltered, but it doesn't mean necessarily that there's not someone with an agenda there. And so I think if you're going to, absolutely right to take a critical approach to mainstream media, we want to see that critical approach also taken to things that we see on social media and across the board. But no easy solutions, I agree.
Thank you for your lecture. That's very good. Just a question about, just similar to what the previous question, just about independence in creating your report. Do you have any input on your editors in terms of how the narrative of your report should be in terms of avoiding that bias? I'm just sort of thinking particularly BBC's coverage of Gaza previously, in the previous months.
When I was at the BBC, I never reported on the Middle East, which is, of course, the most contentious issue, but I never had someone tell me, say this, don't say that. There was an example when I first started reporting on the Middle East at Channel 4, prior even to ever having gone out there, I used the word occupation in my report. And I had a colleague who comes and looks at the reports from a legal perspective at the end of, prior to broadcast, ask, he's like, oh, is that right? Maybe we should say Israeli presence. And I had never been there, I was quite new to reporting on the region. This was a senior figure, so it made me doubt myself. I thought, oh, have I made a mistake? Is that a contentious term? And I thought to myself, I'm pretty sure it's not. This is an established fact. There's many other things that are disputed, but you know, when talking about the West Bank, which is what the report was about, that you know, that there seems an international consensus that is occupied territory. And so I went away, looked at it, came back to him, and said, well, you know, that's not right. I mean, you know, even the British government's own position is to describe these territories as the occupied Palestinian territory. So we are not in contentious territory there. His question was not, I'm sure, from any perspective of kind of bias or personal agenda. I think his perspective was, do I want to be getting a letter of complaint from the Israeli embassy? And you wouldn't get a letter of complaint from the Israeli embassy over that. And often it's a kind of, people can get so afraid of criticism and they begin to self-censor. And I think that can become an issue. I've never experienced anyone trying to tell me what I should say, what we shouldn't say. In fact, when we went into Gaza, one of the reasons we debated it so long is that we were initially under the misapprehension that perhaps we would be subject to Israeli military censorship with our report. As it turned out, actually, and we clarified this before doing it, all they meant was we will review your images, and if there is something that we deem operationally sensitive, i.e. a map or a location of a base, we will either ask you to blur it, and that was standard fare, but we were given categorical assurances the script wouldn't be changed and no pictures would be taken out for editorial purposes. In fact, we filmed two largely naked Palestinian prisoners who had been detained at a checkpoint just with their hands cuffed and in their underwear, and I thought when I filmed it, oh, maybe I should try and put this in my recently deleted folder and try and just slip it past the Israelis. But we showed it to them, and to their credit, they, or perhaps because they just genuinely didn't see there being anything worrying or troubling about the site, they didn't object to it at all.
Thank you very much for the lecture and for your interview previously with the Palestinian ambassador. When you go somewhere, do you go pretty much because you sort of know the story that you want to tell, and you want to go and make sure that that story is told by almost like finding the people to tell the story? Or how much do you go with, there are stories to be told here, we've got an open mind and we'll find out what the stories are?
It's a good question. It's a mixture of both, because obviously when we're deciding on where to go, you're reading quite widely. And so you're reading other reports, either by other journalists or by people like the International Crisis Group, think tanks. And so you build up an idea in your mind of what your report may well look like, what the narrative may well end up being. But ultimately, we have to respond to events on the ground, and things do develop whilst you're there. When we went out to Myanmar, I thought we were going to be doing a story about how the rebels were about to capture their first state capital. When we got there, we realised actually they were on the verge of potentially losing it. You have to adapt to changing events on the ground, but we are also consumers of news as well as producers of it. And so there is a danger of absorbing groupthink, and that's why there's no substitute for going there on the ground and hearing about, you know, things from people directly. It's why, you know, I've been so particularly frustrated that we haven't been able to go to Gaza, because I feel that there must be, without diminishing the fantastic work done by local journalists there, there must be nuances that we could perhaps help bring out that are not being shared. That remains a huge source of frustration for me. But it's a combination of the two always.
Hiya, thank you for this lecture and the previous session too. I'm just wondering, in terms of people's mistrust in the media, so is there anything that can be done to regain people's trust? Just coming back to your previous comment around TikTok videos and YouTube, and they seem to gather more and harness more attention from youth especially.
No, it's a good question. I mean, interestingly, when I was at the BBC and I was in Pakistan and Afghanistan, it was really refreshing to be away from Britain, because everyone loved the BBC there. And so you'd walk into somewhere and you'd say, oh, I'm the BBC. And they'd say, oh, BBC, great. We love you. Come in. And, you know, hear somebody spitting in your face. and, you know, that could come from any direction of the political framework as well. That was sad as well. And I'm torn myself about how much is down to mistakes that we have made in the media and how much it's down to misguided views, perhaps, within the public, or just a growing sense of general distrust in anything that's kind of that seems to be pushed down someone's throat, or any established narrative that's told to you. I mean, I think that's why when you see videos on social media, and they're so powerful, because they're literally often, they look like, and they may well have been edited, but they look like they haven't been edited at all. And TV news reports, you know, perhaps people have seen the Charlie Brooker kind of caricature of, right, you have your voice going up and your voice going down, and then you have your case study and you have your generic shots of some people's feet as they're walking across the bridge. And, you know, there is a formula to news, and that, I think, does contribute to a sense of distrust. And so now people are, even within news, are gravitating more to try and presenting news in a more less formal way, a more kind of engaging first-hand way, whereas previously perhaps audiences wanted a more authoritative figure. They wanted someone in a suit and a tie to say, well, I'm here and this is what is happening. Now people perhaps want you to be holding a phone up like that and saying, well, I'm here and this is what I can see. There's always also going to be a difference between activism and journalism. And I think both sides need each other. Journalists need to interview activists. We need to get tipped off by activists. But we are not activists. And if we were activists, we would not be as credible as I hope that we still remain. And I think the kind of the blurring of those boundaries or the blurring of those expectations is also problematic, because people then are used to seeing something that they feel is raw and unfiltered and is raw and unfiltered, but comes from one perspective. And then when they don't see that matched necessarily from the mainstream media, then they begin to distrust it.
On the question of distrust, do you think that it might be a case of the analysis that goes on? I mean, what you present is what you present. But then when it comes back to the studio and then you get analysis and you get talk shows and so on talking about this, do you think that kind of fudges the issue a little bit?
Commentary is very different from journalism, I suppose. And I've always stayed clear of commentary, partly because I don't think I necessarily have views that are necessarily worth sharing. I think it's more important for me to try and amplify other people's voices, the people who I'm privileged enough to meet. But yeah, I mean, in a way, yes, that is where you get more of an agenda showing through. But I also think, conversely, actually what I really like about being at Channel 4 News, for example, is that we have long studio discussions. So if we take a Middle East conflict as an example, then I don't feel that I have to unpack 75 years plus of history in a 3 or 4 minute report about Israel-Palestine, because I know there's going to be studio interviews afterwards done by our presenters with guests. Then multiple perspectives will be presented. The BBC is somewhere that's close to my heart because I spent many years living there, and I met many of the reporters who were there, and I know that they do deeply care about what the places that they are reporting on. I can't speak to what pressures they may be under or not under in terms of editorial, because I've never reported on that part of the world for the BBC. But as individuals, I know that they are very passionate about trying to tell the story as best they can and try and do justice to it.
Thank you. That brings our session to an end. Please put your hands together for Sukhinder Karmani.
Thank you so much for having me at the Bradford Literature Festival. Thank you so much for coming and listening to my ramblings.
Thank you for listening. And thank you to everyone who attended our 2025 Bradford Literature Festival and helped to make it such a success. You'll be able to listen back to some of our selected events in the new series, coming soon.